Hello, and welcome to the Mystagogy podcast, hosted by the Adult Faith Programs at St. Stephen Martyr Church in Chesapeake, Virginia. In Greek, the word mystagogy means leading through the mysteries. In the earliest centuries of Christianity, mystagogy referred to the practice of helping Christians to appreciate more deeply the Christian mysteries into which they had been initiated by baptism, confirmation, and reception of the Eucharist. This present program of mystagogy is being developed and taught by Barbara Nicolosi Harrington, a university professor of screenwriting, cinema, great books, and theology. In this final presentation on Dante's Paradiso, Barbara covers cantos 20 through 34.
Yeah, let's plunge in. We've been working our way through the planets. And so basically we have one more to do, which is the planet Saturn. And I don't know how they even knew this much about it back in the 13th century. He's very aware that Saturn has these layers here to it, what we would call the rings. But Saturn is going to be the ladder of the contemplatives. Okay. So we talked about last time we met the theologians, and that they have their place in heaven now as all the questions are answered and they're dancing. So now we come to this planet Saturn, and they land there and they see this amazing golden ladder. And this reckons back to the Jacob's vision. Remember, Jacob saw a vision of a big ladder going up to heaven and the angels coming up and down. And so as soon as Dante, the pilgrim, sees it, he's like, oh, this is Jacob's ladder here. So it's like the last planet, and then there's a ladder, which is like the antechamber now to the palace. The heavenly palace is up there at the end. But he says, as soon as he gets his eyes clear, because again, it's always that big bright light is blinding. But then he says, I realized that it was looking like it was hazy. Oh, no, it was souls moving up the ladder, mainly up, but every so often somebody coming down. He says, I saw so many splendors make their way down its bright rungs. I thought that every lamp in all of heaven was pouring forth its ray. So this is, everything's been bright in heaven. This is the brightest of the bright. And it's this brightness being generated by these souls who are making their way up. Okay, here's another artistic rendering. There's a whole bunch of different artists who have tried to paint this image of literally like you're walking up the steps into God's house is what it is. But he says, those sparkling essences, for they flocked together the instant they reached a certain rung. Basically, so what he's talking about here is that he's there. And so the blessed are coming down to talk to him. And they're like they look like a flock of birds. And he says, they're clearly reluctant. And it's because they don't want to leave where they are, but out of love, they're coming down the rungs of the ladder for the church militant. Like that, they're the church triumphant, and that's where they dwell. But every so often, they come down and do it for the good of the church militant. And so basically, in this case, it's him, and they're coming down to talk to him. And so he's going to see in their midst all these famous contemplatives that are dwelling on this planet of Saturn, huh, at the base of the rungs, and they're going up and down. Okay. Yes. So the other thing he notices is all through purgatory and heaven, we've heard music, so much beautiful music. But now on Saturn, the music stops. Absolutely stops, and it's silent. And so Dante says to Beatrice, what's wrong? Why aren't they singing here? And so she in her way, chastens him. And we'll look at that in a second. But basically what she's telling him is that this is the level of the contemplatives, and silence for them is their language of prayer and always has been, that they've perfected it. So it's similar to, remember with Francis, we said poverty isn't a lack, it is an opening. And silence isn't the lack of noise in heaven, it's the language of awe and reverence and contemplation. And so even the beautiful music stops here, that grand silence reigns, right? I told you we used to call it grand silence. And I remember as an extrovert in my very first days as a postulant saying to my friend, there's nothing grand about silence. But anyway, I was sure they named it that just to tease me, grand silence. But the truth is, these people, there are people who are dwelling like this, And so anyway, when Dante says, why is it so quiet? It's creeping me out. And Beatrice says, your sight is mortal, and so apparently is your hearing. And she chastens him a little, and she says that this silence was the thing that they were working all their lives to achieve, to be in a place where they could free themselves from all the noise of their own heart, of the world, of anxieties and stress. And so in heaven, they're granted that perfect silence. So here's some of the saints that we would meet here. These great saints, right? Catherine Drexel and Teresa Lisieux, my favorite, and Saint Bridget and Teresa of Calcutta. We have Edith Stein there, Blessed Teresa of the Cross, and Saint Simon Stock, founder of the Carmelites, and I forget which one that one is. Shoot, sorry about that. Oh, Catherine of Siena. Sorry. Don't get mad. But anyway, she's not one you want to forget. Catherine of Siena and Saint Benedict. That these are some of the great monastic legacy of our faith. And I have to say, when I talk with Protestants, this legacy is one of our richnesses in the Catholic Church. They don't have this because it's reckoned too Catholic in some ways, which is a shame. But the mystical writings of the contemplatives, for the most part, it's a treasury that the church has been collecting and holding and passing on. And it's there for us. And so Dante is like suddenly surrounded by these people who they spent their whole life or their greater part of their lives trying to get through, trying to connect, living as though it was all real, and by making the ultimate wager. I'm going to put it all on the red and believe that there is a God who knows my name and is tracking this effort to connect with him. He says, so they meet. So Peter Damian is a 10th century monk who was a great reformer and ends up all he wants to be is a monk, but the church keeps grabbing him and pulling him out and putting him in charge of things. And he's just like, please let me go back to just being a monk. The next thing you know, he was just a very talented orator, a very talented administrator, and had real good common sense and could solve problems. And so the church kept coming for him. And so that was his big sacrifice. But anyway, he says, I lived on Lenten olive food alone and bore both cold and heat indifferently, rejoicing always more in contemplation. Think of all through the millennia, how many unknown people have done this. I just think of my community up in Boston. There were 96 nuns in the House of Boston. We had about another 80 or 90 out in the houses and the missions. 200 women that prayed 3 hours a day. You don't know their names. And they were praying relentlessly. And even in the apostolate, when we weren't in chapel, we prayed in chapel 3 hours a day. But in the apostolate, it was meant to be in a place of prayer all day long, for our work was the media. So we would be praying for the people who would be reading this, or the people who would be the kids who would be using these things. And in fact, by the way, June 4th, the first week of our coming back, one of my fellow sisters, Sister Helena Raphael, is coming from Boston, from the Daughters of St. Paul. She's going to talk about Humana Vitae and theology of the body. And she's going to bring books that weekend at masses for the parish, to sell at the parish. That's what they do. They make media. So anyway, that's just a little thing. These unknowns, people who gave their whole life, and only God knows. They gave up progeny. They gave up descendants. They gave up making a mark in some way. And now they're just, their name is on a stone somewhere. I remember when I went to see the grave of Brother Lewis, who was a Thomas Merton, and in at the monastery in Genesee there, I think it's Genesee, it's in Kentucky. But I said to the porter at the gate, I want to go see Thomas Merton's grave. And he goes, Brother Lewis, yeah, he's out there, row 17, like the seventh one in. And sure enough, it's just a huge Cistercian monastery. It's been there for hundreds of years. And you go and you walk, and all of these little Brother John, Brother Gregory, Brother, and then there's Brother Lewis, and it's the same as everybody else's. And I thought, I'm here because he was famous, Thomas Merton, but all these other souls gave it all. So Dante says, in the same way we said divine justice last time, you don't have to reckon and keep account, because God is keeping account. And whatever you've suffered in your life as that has been unjust, in heaven, you will be rewarded, because God knows. So in the same way, these people, these masses of people that he meets on the planet Saturn, who are all these contemplatives known only to God, and all of those prayers now have put them at the highest level, basically, of heaven, which is quite cool. So yeah, so St. Peter Damian comes out, and he's talking about the wonder of contemplative life. And so Dante the Pilgrim, still our friend, still Dante, has to make it about him. And so he says, girls, I just always wonder why some people seem to get more graces than me. Here we are at the antechamber of heaven. And he's saying, these people who made it as contemplatives, who made this sacrifice, yeah, I grant you it's great, but I clearly did not have that in me, because God did not put it in me. Why did he put it in them? So Peter Damian is, it's like funny, but he says, and it's Beatrice lets him have it, as she always does. But his father, Peter Damian, though, looks at him very seriously and says this. It says, even heaven's most enlightened soul, that seraph with his eye most set on God. So we're not going to talk about it, but the layers, the ranks of the angels are all around God's throne, and the seraphs are right next to God. And he says, even those seraphs could not provide the why, not satisfy what you have asked. For deep in the abyss of the eternal ordinance, it is cut off from all creative beings' vision. What's he saying here? This question of why didn't God give me the grace that I think I should have had? Why did I have to suffer this? Why, like, even at the threshold of heaven, Dante's still troubled by this, the inequity, if you will, or the apparent inequity. And so finally, Peter Damian just says to him, you couldn't understand if God did explain it. You couldn't understand. You don't have the divine a perspective. And so you just have to have faith at a certain point and believe that God is good and stop feeling like you got a bum deal somehow. Like you just have to let it go. And then he stresses and he says, and to the mortal world, when you return, tell this, lest men continue to trespass and set their steps towards such a reachless goal. The reachless goal is trying to make everything equal because God screwed up. And so it's not that we're not supposed to try to bring justice. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, if you're trying to fix God's mistakes, you're really on the wrong track. And especially starting in your own life, right? But that's a biggie. It's the last lesson of the Divine Comedy. And granted, we've heard it before. We've heard it all through hell. We heard it in purgatory. And now at the very end of heaven, the still thing of, are you going to trust him or not? Are you going to trust him or not? And stop deciding somehow that he doesn't know what you've been through. Okay, so at this point, Peter Damian, because he segues off of this God screwed up mentality that people that's out there into the corruption in the church. And he's like, this is the seed of so much corruption in the church. When people in the church decide God is missing it, he's not doing it right, so we have to fix things. And he says it leads then to people giving themselves permission to act like God, basically. And then he goes on this whole long thing about the corruption in the monastic orders, that these are people who the people of God said, we need you praying there all day. We need you. So we're going to feed you. We're going to bring food to the house. And I know when I was a nun, we used to go to the Boston food vegetable market every week. We'd just drive up with our van and wave at the farmers. And they'd be like, all right, take that crate of corn. And we would fill up our van. And that's how we survived. But it was like those people, even if they weren't Catholic and probably not even Christian, some of them, they acknowledged what we were doing was good. You're praying for us. And so Peter Damian says, so the people of God make all these sacrifices so that some of us can be contemplatives. And then when those people say, I'm now, I'm going to live high on the hog. And this was Teresa of Avila, right? 15 years she hung out in the parlor playing games and not being a real nun. And then finally one day stung to the heart. She almost dies and then realizes, what am I doing? But corruption in religious, I forget who says, the corruption of the best becomes the worst. And that's basically what Peter Damian is saying. So again, Dante then listens to this whole speech and then says to Beatrice, so why doesn't God fix it? Why doesn't he kill the corrupt pope? That's literally what he says. Why doesn't he clean out the Vatican? He could just go zap and all the corruption will be fixed, huh? And then Beatrice says, the sword of heaven is not too soon dyed red, nor yet too late. And she says a little bit more, but basically God is never late. God is never late. And I needed to repeat that to myself about 20 times when I was preparing this. Because I really feel like he is late a lot. But he's never late. We have to believe it as an act of faith. Think of the people in your family who are away from the church, who are stuck in patterns of addiction, who are whatever. It's like, God is never late. Do I believe that? And finally, there's this, basically Beatrice says to him, remember, this is the God who parted the Red Sea. And then she also says, and made the waters of the Jordan run the opposite way. That's who we're talking about here. He can handle whatever it is you think he isn't addressing. He's got it. You just got to love Dante the Pilgrim, huh? Okay, so they finish with all the contemplatives, and it's been this weird, quiet procession. And then all of a sudden, whoosh, up into the fixed stars where all the glowing globes are. So the glowing globes are the real heroes of Christendom. Now, we've been meeting them all along, but we're talking the big dudes now. But we're also talking the angels. We're talking so for Dante, when you look up at the stars, every one of those is a giant of faith. And so we ascend up there, and now we're with them. Okay. The glowing globes. People like Saint Benedict we meet here. Why wasn't he with the contemplatives? Because he's too great. He really has to be a glowing globe. And then we meet Saint Peter here, who's going to question Dante about his faith. We meet Saint John, the evangelist here. He's always depicted holding the chalice because the rumor was, because he wasn't martyred, that he didn't have a chalice to drink. But Christ had said to him, you will have a chalice. From the chalice I drink of, you will drink of. And so he suffered. It just, he wasn't martyred. But anyway, these are just some of the fixed stars, the real giants of faith that we meet. Okay. So soon as they get up there, boom, all of a sudden, the heavens just suddenly open in front of him, and he gets this vision of Christ triumphant. And Christ is on the right hand of the Father, and on Christ's right hand is his mother. But all of the saints and angels gathered around in this stunning, incomprehensible vision of the whole family. And so one of the things Dante is saying is, when I was in hell, I thought, wow, there's so many souls down here. But now I'm in heaven, and wow, there's a lot of souls here too. And it's a beautiful triumph. Christ saves more than he loses in Dante, which for me was good to know. So there's tons of artwork of this moment, or this scene in heaven, of the whole family gathered around. And it's also called the Garden of Christ's Triumph. The center of the garden, Our Lady is sitting at Christ's right hand, and then all the apostles are around her. And it mirrors Pentecost, that the apostles were around Mary at Pentecost. Okay, so the center of the garden is this one. The rose in which the Word became incarnate is there. There are the lilies. There are the lilies by whose odor men found the road that evermore runs straight. I love this. What is he saying? He's saying that Mary, in her compassion, has used lilies to get us back on the way we should be on when we wander. That the aroma of the lily, something beautiful, is how Our Lady has come into our lives and drawn us back on the path we should be on. And so one of the things all around her is this just massive garden of these lilies, which represent all of those graces she obtained. But she wins us with beauty and gentleness. And so think about your own life. There's been times when you do the right thing because you're scared, but there's also times you do the right thing because all of a sudden it just seemed right to you, or for a reason you don't even know, but you're being drawn by something beautiful and good. And Dante says it's all Our Lady. That's her method. So the rose, okay? So the rose applies first and foremost to Our Lady, but then also to the entire human project, if you will. That the point is this big rose. Now, I thought we'd just take a second and ask, what is it about roses? Why roses, huh? They're different. Yeah, they really are. But if you look at them and say what, they almost are ethereal. They have a perfection to them. And a fragrance, yeah. They're soft and yet they hold their shape, don't they? Huh? And they're layered. I never get tired of looking at them. And there's tons of poems about roses, tons and tons. This is my outside my house in California. I had 27 babies and I cried when I left them. I didn't care about anything else I left in California, my friends. But other than that, it was my 27 rose bushes that bloomed out there like 9 to 10 months a year. And they always made me happy. They always reminded me of God. This is a poem by Grace Brana. No hand but one divine could make this rose of mine. No power but God's creates such loveliness. But how the roses grow, I know not, nor can know. I only know their beauty is to bless. So this is the image Dante chooses, not only for Our Lady and her place in the family, but the point of it all is that God is constructing this mystical rose. So now the music starts here when he's looking at this vision of Christ and Mary at his right hand and all of the stars of the church gathered around, right? And so they start singing the Regina Caeli. Now, I begged Jessica to please, can we sing the Regina Caeli after Mass on Easter? Because the Regina Caeli replaces the Angelus in the Easter season. In the convent, we would sing it 3 times a day. Regina Caeli, letare, ole. Or Regina Caeli. We had about 10 versions because you're singing it all 3 times a day all through Easter. But it's basically saying, Queen of Heaven, rejoice. He who you deserve to bear has risen as he said. Hallelujah. So it's a short little verse. It's a very dramatic moment in the book where it's been all quiet. And all of a sudden, now he sees this vision and you hear this burst of music. Anyway, Jessica said she would play Regina Caeli after the Mass on Easter Sunday. So listen for it. It's very beautiful. So here we are now really heading towards the end. And there's 3 last things to do. And that is Dante has to pass a test. Dante the pilgrim. He has to say what faith is, what hope is, and what love is. And so sure enough, Saint Peter comes out with his keys, shaking his keys, and says, tell me what faith is. And he says, faith is the substance of what we hope to see and the argument for what we have not seen. It's the argument. It's to convince ourselves and the world. Faith is that thing that convinces them when we don't have other evidence or proof. And he says, this dear gem on which all good and all power of good are founded. Everything that you do that is good is because of your faith. And so then St. Peter says, say more. Tell me literally what you believe. And so then Dante has this little mini creed, which I thought I'd read. He says, this is what powers everything in my life. I have faith in one God, who is loved, desired by all creation, soul eternal, who moves the turning heavens himself unmoved. And I believe in three persons, this Trinity, an essence triune and single, in whose being is and are conjoined to eternity. This is the beginning, the spark shot free that gnaws and widens into a living flame, and a star in heaven shines in me. So he's learned this after his journey. He's learned what his faith is. And so they move on, and I forget who comes up to him next. Maybe St. Bernard, but another one comes up and says, tell me about hope. What's hope? And he says, hope is the certain expectation. I love those two words married together. The certain expectation of future glory. It's the fruit of grace and the good a person does. Interesting. So you have hope because you are really trying to live according to your faith. And so grace makes that possible, but it's like your hope is based also on the choices that you make. And finally, Beatrice says to him, all right, this is the biggie. Tell me what love is. And so Dante has this beautiful, it's a two-page thing in the book, and I'm just pulling a part out. But basically, he's love is what makes everything go. It's what powers everything. He says, the more we understand, and he says, and all good that we experience is going to make that love grow. And he says, I'm looking at my life. I'm looking at what's happened to me. I'm looking at the fact that I am. And all of that makes my heart feel more love if I will let it. So he absolutely connects love to gratitude. That it's a response of gratitude where you have no way of saying thank you. So you do something silly. Give two people who've made a million sacrifices a few flowers. But basically what you say is, I love you. I love you because you're so good. And that's what Dante's saying now on this journey that he's been on that has led him to this. Every good thing is nothing more than love's own reflection. I've realized that now. And that's been a biggie for him, remember? Because he likes the stuff of the world. But he realizes, I only like it because it's coming from God's heart of love. The existence of the world and my own too, the death he took on himself that I might live, heaven, what we all hope for, all of these things fuel love in me. And the more I think on them, the more love I feel, the more love I then have flowing through me. And then this comes out into the world. And so Beatrice says, that'll do. That'll do. And so then he gets this one last vision of this rose. And the cool thing about the rose is it's multicolored because it's made up of all of us. And it's breathtaking in its complexity and its beauty. It's a pattern no man could make. And he says that no man could have made this complex, beautiful harmony. But he's looking at it and he understands what God's doing in some weird way at last. That's what we're headed for. So there's a lot more, but I cut to the chase. So I thought in our last few minutes here, anybody want to say anything about the Divine Comedy? Hell, purgatory, heaven, your experience of the journey of it, what it's meant to you, or anything at all. Anybody have anything they want to share? Are you glad we did it? Yeah, how come? Yeah.
It's made me think more deeply about the faith. Mm-hmm. all these different steps along the way.
Oh, it made me think more deeply. This is good. Because what is Dante saying? The big problem is we're all thinking wrongly. That's why the whole book ends in a test. Are you finally thinking rightly? Very good. Thanks. Anybody else? Yes.
I had it in high school, and I really didn't understand it. But now, with life behind me, studying again, with a whole perspective, mm-hmm. such a neat medium, and what is love?
Yeah.
All three stages.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah. Yeah. This is like my ninth time through it. I know it doesn't seem like it, but believe me, it's tough work. But I've had to learn it because I teach it. And every time something else really pops. Yeah. And so that's one of the reasons it's miraculous work, I think, because it just never gets old, really. Anybody else? Yes.
Somewhat astounded that he wrote this.
Yeah.
I mean, the scope of his writing is, you have to stand in awe of that as something that God, of the gift that he had.
Yes.
To even see and imagine these things on the scale that he did.
You're right. And he actually says in the Paradiso, all of this has been given to me as a vision. I'm a good poet, but I'm nowhere this good. And yeah, he makes that claim that a lot of the book is things he just saw, like visions that were given to him. Actually, there's a moment in the book, which I didn't talk about, right before he leaves, right when they leave Saturn and they get swept up into the fixed globes, Beatrice says, stop and look back at where you've come. And he does. He looks all the way back down through heaven, through purgatory, and through hell. And then he starts singing a song of praise to God. Like, you took me on this journey. Look how far I've come. And so that's meant to be us too, right? Yeah. I just did the Odyssey with my freshmen. And part of Homer's wisdom is, you cannot mature at a certain point if you don't go to a nikia, on a nikia. Nikia in Greek means the journey to the dead, right? That you have to talk to the dead. You have to look back and hear the lessons of those before who have made mistakes and brood over them. And then that opens the door for you finally of wisdom. But nobody wants to do it because it's spooky and creepy to some extent. But yeah.
Makes it be up. There's a sense in which in lots of moderns think of getting smarter and smarter. We have word processors and artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And his work, the profundity, the creativity, the depth of it is nobody's. I don't see many people writing like that today.
Yeah.
And there's sort of an arrogance about modernity and postmodernity.
Yeah.
So now we've got all this data.
Yeah.
But
we don't have a lot of wisdom. We got a lot of facts, but we don't have a lot of wisdom. Yeah. There's no one, even it's like there's five people who wrote like this: Homer, Shakespeare, Dante. It's a very elite kind of thing that I don't think anybody today could begin the breadth of. There's so much classical knowledge in it. He knows everything about the Greek tradition. He knows everything about philosophy and all of the great writers. But we're not that educated anymore, which is ironic. And in fact, it's one of the problems. People reading this book 100 years ago understood the references. People today don't. And when I say Minotaur to my students, I have to draw it for them, or I have to find a picture. They don't know what it is, but 100 years ago, people did. So it's sad in one way that we're losing the ability to even read the great works. But anyway, this one's going to make it. It's going to last. Yes.
I'm just so grateful for the ability to even understand a little bit that I understood. And thinking, I wouldn't even touch that book here if I hadn't been in his room.
That's so cool. That really warms my heart. Good. Yes, Garrett.
I think the pinnacle could be, obviously, the pinnacle is the pyramid of heaven, right? But the part that always gets me when I'm going through Dante is that interaction between St. Dominic and St. Francis, where, like, their parties never go along, but in heaven, everyone's in communion and all that strife is melted away.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's extremely hopeful, and it also just reminds me of our foolishness as human beings.
Yeah. Can you imagine God up there watching the Dominicans and the Franciscans fight over stuff down here? He sends these two amazing saints, great saints with tremendous insight to keep the church going and to elevate it. And then we turn it into a rivalry contest of I'm better than you. And so there it is. But yeah.
Could you just find the mathematics in his writing?
Yeah. Yeah. 33, 33, 34. So 33 cantos in hell, 33 cantos in purgatory, 34 in heaven, because it makes sense that heaven would get one more, which equals 100, but they match. When you read canto number 8 in hell, it matches to canto 8 in purgatory and then pays off in canto 8 in heaven. Like the interweaving, the plan of the whole thing is so unbelievable. And the way the meters are, the patterns of the verses, and so that every canto is 100 lines. And even in those, they're synchronized. So it's that he put something like this together is monumental. 13 years, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
In the church's history since Cardo, has there been a person considered a prophet?
We don't use that word, but there have definitely been prophetic voices in the church. And in some ways, prophet is a pre-Christian word. It's a word for people who God used until he came. But yeah, these people that he highlights all through Paradiso are the prophetic voices.
And himself.
Yes. He says that. In my humility, I have to acknowledge I am the greatest poet of Christendom, but it's not my doing. But no, he can't believe what he's doing either. Yeah. But I think that he does. He spends the Paradiso is basically pointing to us, for us, at these great figures that are our legacy. And it's like the theologians, the martyrs, and then the contemplatives, and then the giants. And why, like St. Augustine's up there with St. Peter and St. Francis, and these are gifts of God. It's in no other way to explain that they existed and what they did. And so for us to really give them a hearing, why did Francis's movement work so well? What was the... We've made St. Francis into this effeminate little bird watcher. This is the guy who had the stigmata. He'd throw himself into rose bushes. But poverty, he gave poverty back to the church. He gave the crash, the Christmas Nativity, was St. Francis saying, look how poor Jesus was. It wasn't supposed to be party time at Christmas, right? It was to focus the church on Christ's poverty. But to really listen, there's a book called The Little Flowers of St. Francis, which are epigrams that they recorded at his brothers of things Francis said. And you should get this book and understand why Francis changed the church and basically saved it. When Jesus appears to him, he says, rebuild my church. And so something that Francis had was able to achieve that. And the question is, how many Catholics today can really tell you? What did St. Francis bring to the church? Most people are going to say, he liked animals. Meanwhile, St. Francis is up there throwing up. Did I like animals? Yes, I liked animals, but what? I gave one freaking homily to the animals, and now I'm the animal god. But when you talk about people like St. Benedict and the rule of St. Benedict, what was Benedict's insight that gave monasticism to the Christian community? He figured something out. Ora et labora, simplicity of life, prayer and work. And so each of these towering figures is there for us. To at least we should read them as much as we listen to some motivational speaker. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for this year. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Mystagogy Podcast. The music for the podcast is provided by George Serra. Learn more about his music in the show notes. Until next time, be well and God bless.